Wap thought of himself chiefly as a supplicant. I come as a beggar into the land of thy messenger, God. He had his suspicions about Odraid. The Reverend Mother had brought him here to drain him of his knowledge before killing him. With God's help, I may surprise her yet. He knew his body was proof against an Ixion probe, although she obviously did not have such a cumbersome device on her person. But it was the strength of his own will and confidence in God's grace that reassured Wap. And what if the hand they hold out to us is held out in sincerity? That, too, would be God's doing. Alliance with the Bene Gesserit, firm control of Rakkas. What a dream that was. The Shariat ascendant at last, and the Bene Gesserit as missionaries. When Shiana again missed her footing and uttered another small sound of complaint, Odraid said, "Don't favor yourself, child." Odraid saw Wav's shoulders stiffen. He did not like that peremptory manner with his blessed one. There was backbone in the little man. Odraid recognized it as the strength of fanaticism. Even if the worm came to kill him, Wap would not flee. Faith in God's will would carry him directly into his own death, unless he were shaken out of his religious security. Odraid suppressed a smile. She could follow his thinking process. God will soon reveal his purpose. But Waff was thinking about his cells growing in the slow renewal at Vandalong. No matter what happened here, his cells would carry on for the Bene Tlilax, and for God. A serial Waff always serving the great belief. "I can smell Shaitan, you know," Shiana said. "Right now?" Odraid looked up at the causeway ahead of them. Waff already was a few steps onto that arcing surface. "No, only when he comes," Shiana said. "Of course you can, child. Anyone could. I can smell him a long way off." Odraid inhaled deeply through her nose, sorting the smells from the background of burnt flint. Faint whiffs of melange. Ozone. Something distinctly acid. She motioned for Shiana to precede her single file onto the causeway. Waff was holding his steady 20 paces ahead. The causeway dipped down to the desert some 60 meters ahead of him. "I will taste the sand at the first opportunity," Odraid thought. "That will tell me many things." As she mounted the causeway over the water moat, she looked off to the southwest at a low barrier along the horizon. Abruptly, Odraid was confronted by a compelling other memory. There was none of the crispness in it of actual vision, but she recognized it, a mingling of images from the deepest sources within her. "Damn," she thought, "not now." There was no escape. Such intrusions came with purpose, an unavoidable demand upon her awareness. Warning. She squinted at the horizon, allowing the other memory to superimpose itself. A long-ago high barrier far away out there. People moving along the top of it. There was a ferry bridge in that memory distance, insubstantial and beautiful. It linked one part of that vanished barrier to another part, and she knew without seeing it that a river ran beneath that long-gone bridge. The Idaho River. Now the superimposed image provided movement. Objects falling from the bridge. They were too far away to identify, but she had the labels for this image projection now. With a sense of horror and elation, she identified that scene. The ferry bridge was collapsing, tumbling into the river below it. This vision was not some random destruction. This was classical violence carried in many memories, which had come down to her in the moments of spice agony. Odraid could classify the finely tuned components of the image. Thousands of her ancestors had watched that scene in imaginative reconstruction. Not a real visual memory, but an assemblage of accurate reports. That is where it happened. Odraid stopped and let the image projections have their way with her awareness. Warning. Something dangerous had been identified. She did not try to dig out the warning substance. If she did that, she knew it could fall apart in skeins, any one of which might be relevant, but the original certainty would vanish. This thing out there was fixed in the Atreides' history. Leto II, the tyrant, had fallen to his dissolution from that fairy bridge. The great worm of Rakkus, the tyrant god emperor himself, had been tumbled from that bridge on his wedding peregrination. There, right there in the Idaho River beneath his destroyed bridge, the tyrant had been submerged in his own agony. Right there, the transubstantiation from which the divided god was born, it all began there. Why is that a warning? Bridge and river had vanished from this land. The high wall that had enclosed the tyrant's dry land, Sarir, was eroded into a broken line on a heat-shimmering horizon. If a worm came now with its encapsulated pearl of the tyrant's forever dreaming memory, would that memory be dangerous? So Taraza's opposition in the Sisterhood argued. He will awaken. Taraza and her advisors denied even the possibility. Still, this klaxon from Odraid's other memories could not be shunted aside. Reverend Mother, why have we stopped? Odraid felt her awareness lurch back into an immediate present that demanded her attention. Out there in that warning vision was where the tyrant's endless dream began, but other dreams intruded. Shiana stood in front of her with a puzzled expression. I was looking out there, Odraid pointed. That was where Shai-Hulud began, Shiana. Waf stopped at the end of the causeway, one step short of the encroaching sand, and now about 40 paces ahead of Odraid and Shiana. Odraid's voice brought him to stiff alertness, but he did not turn. Odraid could feel the displeasure in his posture. Waf would not like even a hint of cynicism directed at his prophet. He always suspected cynicism from reverend mothers, especially where religious matters were concerned. Waf was not yet ready to accept that the long-tested and feared Bene Gesserit might share his great belief. That ground would have to be filled in with care, as was always the way with the Missionaria Protectiva. They say there was a big river, Shiana said. Odraid heard the lilting note of derision in Shiana's voice. The child learned quickly. Waf turned and scowled at them. He heard it too. What was he thinking about Shiana now? Odraid held Shiana's shoulder with one hand and pointed with the other. There was a bridge right there. The great wall of the Sarir was left open there to permit the passage of the Idaho River. The bridge spanned that break. Shiana sighed. A real river, she whispered. Not a canot, and too big for a canal, Odraid said. I've never seen a river, Shiana said. That was where they dumped Shai-Hulud into the river, Odraid said. She gestured to her left. Over on this side, many kilometers in that direction, he built his palace. There's nothing over there but sand, Shiana said. The palace was torn down in the famine times, Odraid said. People thought there was a hoard of spice in it. They were wrong, of course. He was much too clever for that. Shiana leaned close to Odraid and whispered, There is a great treasure of the spice, though. The chantings tell about it. I've heard it many times. They say it's in a cave. Odraid smiled. Shiana referred to the oral history, of course. And she had almost said, My father. Meaning her real father who had died in this desert. Odraid already had lured that story from the girl. still whispering close to Odraid's ear, Shiana said, "Why is that little man with us? I don't like him." "It is necessary for the demonstration," Odraid said. Waf took that moment to step off the causeway onto the first soft slope of open sand. He moved with care, but no visible hesitation. Once on the sand, he turned, his eyes glistening in the hot sunlight, and stared first at Shiana, and then at Odraid. "Still that awe in him when he looks at Shiana," Odraid thought. "What great things he believes he will discover here. He will be restored. And the prestige." Shiana sheltered her eyes with one hand and studied the desert. "Shaitan likes the heat," Shiana said. "People hide inside when it's hot, but that's when Shaitan comes." "Not Shai-Halud," Odraid thought. "Shaitan." "You predicted it well, Tyrant. What else did you know about our times?" Was it really the Tyrant out there, dormant in all of his worm descendants? None of the analyses Odraid had studied gave a sure explanation of what had driven one human being to make himself into a symbiote with that original worm of Arrakis. What went through his mind in the millennia of that awful transformation? Was any of that, even the smallest fragment, preserved in today's Rakian worms? "He is near, Mother," Shiana said. "Do you smell him?" Waf peered apprehensively at Shiana. Odraid inhaled deeply, a rich swelling of cinnamon on the bitter flint undertones. Fire, brimstone, the crystal-banked inferno of the great worm. She stooped and brought up a pinch of blown sand to her tongue. All of the background was there, the dune of other memory, and the Rakis of this day. Shiana pointed at an angle to her left, directly into the light breeze from the desert. "Out there. We must hurry." Without waiting for permission from Odraid, Shiana ran lightly down the causeway, past Waf, and out onto the first dune. She stopped there until Odraid and Waf caught up with her. Off the dune face, she led them, up another with sand clogging their passage, out along a great curving barrican with wisps of dusty saltation blowing from its crest. Soon they had put almost a kilometer between themselves and the water-girded security of Dar es Balat. Again Shiana stopped. Waf came to a panting halt behind her. Perspiration glistened where his stillsuit hood crossed his brow. Odraid stopped a pace behind Waf. She took deep, calming breaths while she peered past Waf to where Shiana's attention was fixed. A furious tide of sand had poured across the desert beyond the dune where they stood, driven by a storm wind. Bedrock lay exposed in a long, narrow avenue of giant boulders, which lay scattered and upturned like the broken building blocks of a mad Promethean. Through this wild maze, the sand had poured like a river, leaving its signature in deep scratches and gouges, then plunging off a low escarpment to lose itself in more dunes. "Down there," Shiana said, pointing at the avenue of bedrock. Off their dune she went, sliding and scrambling in spilled sand. At the bottom she stopped beside a boulder at least twice her height. Waf and Odraid paused just behind her. The slit face of another giant barrican, sinuous as the back of a sporting whale, lifted into the silver-blue sky beside them. Odraid used the pause to recompose her oxygen balance. That mad run had made great demands on flesh. Waf, she noted, was red-faced and breathing deeply. The flinty cinnamon smell was oppressive in the confined passage. Waf sniffed and rubbed at his nose with the back of a hand. Shiana lifted herself on one toe, pivoted, and darted 10 paces across the rocky avenue. She put one foot up on the sandy incline of the outer dune and lifted both arms to the sky. Slowly at first, and then with increasing tempo, she began to dance, moving up onto the sand. The thopter sounds grew louder overhead. "Listen," Shiana called, not pausing in her dance. It was not to the thopters that she called their attention. Audrey turned her head to present both ears to a new sound intruding on their rock-tumbled maze. A sibilant hiss, subterranean and muted by sand. It became louder with shocking swiftness. There was heat in it, a noticeable warming of the breeze that twisted down their rocky avenue. The hissing swelled to a crescendo roar. Abruptly, the crystal-ringed gaping of a gigantic mouth lifted over the dune directly above Shiana. "Shaitan!" Shiana screamed, not breaking the rhythm of her dance. "Here I am, Shaitan!" As it crested the dune, the worm dipped its mouth downward toward Shiana. Sand cascaded round her feet, forcing her to stop her dance. The smell of cinnamon filled the rocky defile. The worm stopped above them. "Messenger of God," Waff breathed. Heat dried the perspiration on Odraid's exposed face and made the automatic insulation of her stillsuit puff outward perceptibly. She inhaled deeply, sorting the components behind that cinnamon assault. The air around them was sharp with ozone and swiftly oxygen-rich. Her senses at full alert, Odraid stored impressions. "If I survive," she thought. Yes, this was valuable data. The day might come when others would use it. Shiana backed out of the spilled sand onto the exposed rock. She resumed her dance, moving more wildly, flinging her head at each turn. Hair whipped across her face, and each time she whirled to confront the worm, she screamed, "Shaitan!" Daintily, like a child on unfamiliar ground, the worm once more moved forward. It slid across the dune crest, curled itself down onto the exposed rock, and presented its burning mouth slightly above and about 2 paces from Shiana. As it stopped, Odraid became conscious of the deep furnace rumbling of the worm. She could not tear her gaze away from the reflections of lambent orange flames within the creature. It was a cave of mysterious fire. Shiana stopped her dance. She clenched both fists at her sides and stared back at the monster she had summoned. Odraid took timed breaths, the controlled pacing of a reverend mother gathering all of her powers. If this was the end, well, she had obeyed Taraz's orders. Let the Mother Superior learn what she would from the watchers overhead. "Hello, Shaitan," Shiana said. "I have brought a reverend mother and a man of the Tlilazu with me." Waff slumped to his knees and bowed. Odraid slipped past him to stand beside Shiana. Shiana breathed deeply. Her face was flushed. Odraid heard the click-ticking of their overworked stillsuits. The hot, cinnamon-drenched air around them was charged with the sounds of this meeting, all dominated by the murmurous burning within the quiescent worm. Waff came up beside Odraid, his trance-like gaze fixed on the worm. "I am here," he whispered. Odraid silently cursed him. Any unwarranted noise could attract this beast onto them. She knew what Waff was thinking, though. No other Tlilazu had ever stood this close to a descendant of his prophet. Not even the Rakian priests had ever done this. With her right hand, Shiana made a sudden downward gesture. "Down to us, Shaitan," she said. The worm lowered its gaping mouth until the internal fitpyre filled the rocky defile in front of them. Her voice little more than a whisper, Shiana said, "See how Shaitan obeys me, Mother?" Odraid could feel Shiana's control over the worm, a pulse of hidden language between child and monster. It was uncanny. Her voice rising in impudent arrogance, Shiana said, "I will ask Shaitan to let us ride him." She scrambled up the slip face of the dune beside the worm. Immediately, the great mouth lifted to follow her movements. "Stay there!" Shiana shouted. The worm stopped. It's not her words that command it, Odraid thought. Something else. towels. Mother, come with me, Shiana called. Thrusting Wath ahead of her, Odred obeyed. They scrambled up the sandy slope behind Shiana. Dislodged sand spilled down beside the waiting worm, piling up in the defile. Ahead of them, the worm's tapering tail curved along the dune crest. Shiana led them at a sand-clotted trot to the very tip of the thing. There she gripped the leading edge of a ring in the corrugated surface and scrambled up onto her desert beast. More slowly, Odred and Wap followed. The worm's warm surface felt non-organic to Odred, as though it were some Ixian artifact. Shiana skipped forward along the back and squatted just behind its mouth, where the rings bulged thick and wide. Like this, Shiana said. She leaned forward and clutched beneath the leading edge of a ring, lifting it slightly to expose pink softness underneath. Wath obeyed her immediately, but Odred moved with more caution, storing impressions. The ring's surface was as hard as plascrete and covered with tiny incrustations. Odred's fingers probed the softness under the leading edge. It pulsed faintly. The surface around them lifted and fell with an almost imperceptible rhythm. Odred heard a tiny rasping with each movement. Shiana kicked the worm's surface behind her. "Shaitan, go," she said. The worm did not respond. "Please, Shaitan," Shiana pleaded. Odred heard the desperation in Shiana's voice. The child was so confident of her Shaitan, but Odred knew that the girl had been allowed to ride only that first time. Odred had the full story from death wish to priestly confusion, but none of it told her what would happen next. Abruptly, the worm lurched into motion. It lifted sharply, twisted to the left, and made a tight curve out of the rocky defile, then moved directly away from Dar es Balat into the open desert. "We go with God!" Waf shouted. The sound of his voice shocked Odred. Such wildness. She sensed the power in his faith. The thwack-thwack of following ornithopters came from overhead. The wind of their passage whipped past Odred full of ozone, and the hot furnace odors stirred up by the friction of the rushing behemoth. Odred glanced over her shoulders at the thopters, thinking how easy it would be for enemies to rid this planet of a troublesome child, an equally troublesome reverend mother, and a despised Tlilazu. All in one violently vulnerable moment on the open desert. The priestly Cabal might attempt it, she knew, hoping that Odred's own watchers up there would be too late to prevent it. Would curiosity and fear hold them back? Odred admitted to a mighty curiosity herself. Where is this thing taking us? Certainly it was not headed toward Keen. She lifted her head and peered past Shiana. On the horizon directly ahead lay that telltale indentation of fallen stones, that place where the tyrant had been spilled from the surface of his ferry bridge. The place of other memory warning. Abrupt revelation locked Odred's mind. She understood the warning. The tyrant had died at a place of his own choosing. Many deaths had left their imprint on that place, but his the greatest. The tyrant chose his peregrination route with purpose. Shiana had not told her worm to go there. It moved that way of its own volition. The magnet of the tyrant's endless dream drew it back to the place where the dream began. There was this drylander who was asked which was more important, a liter jon of water or a vast pool of water. The drylander thought a moment and then said, "The liter jon is more important. No single person could own a great pool of water. But a liter jon you could hide under your cloak and run away with it. No one would know." The Jokes of Ancient Dune, Bene Gesserit Archives. It was a long session in the No Globes practice hall, Duncan in a mobile cage driving the exercise. adamant that this particular training series would continue until his new body had adapted to the 7 central attitudes of combat response against attack from 8 directions. His green single suit was dark with perspiration. 20 days they had been at this one lesson. Tag knew the ancient lore that Duncan revived here, but knew it by different names and sequencing. Before they had been into it 5 days, Tag doubted the superiority of modern methods. Now he was convinced that Duncan did something completely new, mixing the old with what he had learned in the keep. Tag sat at his own control console, as much an observer as a participant. The consoles that guided the dangerous shadow forces in this practice had required mental adjustment by Tag. But he felt familiar with them now and moved the attack with facility and frequent inspiration. A simmering Lucilla glanced into the hall occasionally. She watched and then left without comment. Tag did not know what Duncan was doing about the imprinter, but there was a feeling that the reawakened Gola played a delaying game with his seductress. She would not allow that to continue long, Tag knew, but it was out of his hands. Duncan no longer was too young for the imprinter. That young body carried a mature male mind with experiences from which to make his own decisions. Duncan and Tag had been on the floor with only one break all morning. Hunger pangs gnawed at Tag, but he felt reluctant to halt the session. Duncan's abilities had climbed to a new level today, and he was still improving. Tag, seated in a fixed console's cage seat, twisted the attack forces into a complex maneuver, striking from left, right, and above. The Harkonnen Armory had produced an abundance of these exotic weapons and training instruments, some of which Tag had known only from historical accounts. Duncan knew them all, apparently, and with an intimacy that Tag admired. Hunter-seekers geared to penetrate a force shield were part of the shadow system they use now. They automatically slow down to go through the shield, Duncan explained in his young old voice. Too fast to strike, of course, and the shield repels. Shields of that type have almost gone out of fashion, Tag said. A few societies maintain them as a kind of sport, but otherwise... Duncan executed a riposte of blurred speech that dropped 3 hunter-seekers to the floor, damaged enough to require the No-Globe's maintenance services. He removed the cage and damped the system, but left it idling while he came over to Tag, breathing deeply but easily. Looking past Tag, Duncan smiled and nodded. Tag whirled, but there was only the flick of Lucilla's gown as she left them. "It's like a duel," Duncan said. "She tries to thrust through my guard, and I counterattack." "Have a care," Tag said. "That's a full reverend mother." "I've known a few of them in my time, Bashar." Once more, Tag found himself confounded. He had been warned that he would have to readjust to this different Duncan Idaho, but he had not fully anticipated the constant mental demands of that readjustment. The look in Duncan's eyes right now was disconcerting. "Our roles are changed a bit, Bashar," Duncan said. He picked up a towel from the floor and mopped his face. "I'm no longer sure of what I can teach you," Tag admitted. He wished, though, that Duncan would take his warnings about Lucilla. Did Duncan imagine that the reverend mothers of those ancient days were identical with the women of today? Tag thought that highly unlikely. In the way of all other life, the sisterhood evolved and changed. It was obvious to Tag that Duncan had come to a decision about his place in Taraz's machinations. Duncan was not merely biding his time. He was training his body to a personally chosen peak, and he had made a judgment about the Bene Gesserit. "He has made that judgment on insufficient data," Tag thought. Duncan dropped the towel and looked at it for a moment. "Let me be the judge of what you can teach me, Bashar." He turned and stared narrowly at Tag, seated in the cage. Tag inhaled deeply. He smelled the faint ozone from all of this durable Harkonnen equipment ticking away in readiness for Duncan's return to action. The goalless perspiration carried a bitter dominant. Duncan sneezed. Teg sniffed, recognizing the omnipresent dust of their activities. It could be more tasted than smelled at times. Alkaline. Over it all was the fragrance of the air scrubbers and oxy-regenerators. There was a distinct floral aroma built into the system, but Teg could not identify the flower. In the month of their occupation, the globe also had taken on human odors, slowly insinuated into the original composite. Perspiration, cooking smells, the never-quite-suppressed acridity of waste reclamation. To Teg, these reminders of their presence were oddly offensive, and he found himself sniffing and listening for sounds of intrusion, something more than the echoing passage of their own footsteps and the subdued metallic clashings from the kitchen area. Duncan's voice intruded. "You're an odd man, Bashar." "What do you mean?" "There's your resemblance to the Duke Leto. The facial identity is weird. He was a bit shorter than you, but the identity..." He shook his head, thinking of the Bene Gesserit designs behind those genetic markers in Teg's face. The hawk look, the crease lines, and that inner thing, that certainty of moral superiority. How moral, and how superior? According to the records he had seen at the keep, and Duncan was sure they had been placed there especially for him to discover, Teg's reputation was an almost universal thing throughout human society of this age. At the Battle of Markon, it had been enough for the enemy to know that Teg was there opposite them in person. They sued for terms. Was that true? Duncan looked at Teg in the console cage and put this question to him. "Reputation can be a beautiful weapon," Teg said. "It often spills less blood." "At Arbelo, why did you go to the front with your troops?" Duncan asked. Teg showed surprise. "Where did you learn that?" "At the keep. You might have been killed. What would that have served?" Teg reminded himself that this young flesh standing over him held unknown knowledge, which must guide Duncan's quest for information. It was in that unknown area, Teg suspected, that Duncan was most valuable to the Sisterhood. "We took severe losses at Arbelo on the preceding 2 days," Teg said. "I failed to make a correct assessment of the enemy's fear and fanaticism. But the risk of..." "My presence at the front said to my own people, 'I share your risks.' The keep's record said Arbelo had been perverted by face dancers. Patrine told me you vetoed your aides when they urged you to sweep the planet clean, sterilize it, and..." "You were not there, Duncan." "I am trying to be." "So you spared your enemy against all advice, except for the face dancers. But then you walked unarmed through the enemy ranks, and before they had laid down their weapons, to assure them they would not be mistreated. That was very dangerous." "Was it? Many of them came over to us with a final assault on Croynin, where we broke the anti-sisterhood forces." Duncan stared hard at Teg. Not only did this old Bashar resemble Duke Leto in appearance, but he also had that same Atreides charisma. A legendary figure even among his former enemies. Teg had said he was descended from Ganima of the Atreides, but there had to be more in it than that. The ways of the Bene Gesserit breeding mastery awed him. "We will go back to the practice now," Duncan said. "Don't damage yourself. You forget, Bashar. I remember a body as young as this one and right here on Jayadi Prime. Gamu. It was properly renamed, but my body still recalls the original. That is why they sent me here. I know it." Of course he would know it, Teg thought. Restored by the brief respite, Teg introduced a new element in the attack and sent a sudden burn line against Duncan's left side. How easily Duncan parried the attack. He was using an oddly mixed variation on the five attitudes, each response seemingly invented before it was required. "Each attack is a feather floating on the infinite road," Duncan said. His voice gave no hint of exertion. As the feather approaches, it is diverted and removed. As he spoke, he parried the shifting attack and countered. Tag's Mentat logic followed the movements into what he recognized as dangerous places. Dependencies and key logs. Duncan shifted over to attack, moving ahead of it, pacing his movements rather than responding. Tag was forced to his utmost abilities as the shadow forces burned and flickered across the floor. Duncan's weaving figure in its mobile cage danced along the space between them. Not one of Tag's hunter-seekers or burn-line counters touched the moving figure. Duncan was over them, under them, seemingly totally unafraid of the real pain that this equipment could bring him. Once more, Duncan increased the speed of his attack. A bolt of pain shot up Tag's left arm, from his hand on the controls to his shoulder. With a sharp exclamation, Duncan shut down the equipment. "Sorry, Bashar. That was superb defense on your part, but I'm afraid age defeated you." Once more, Duncan crossed the floor and stood over Tag. "A little pain to remind me of the pain I caused you," Tag said. He rubbed his tingling arm. "Blame the heat of the moment," Duncan said. "We have done enough for now." "Not quite," Tag said. "It is not enough to strengthen only your muscles." At Tag's words, Duncan felt an alerting sensation throughout his body. He sensed the disorganized touch of that uncompleted thing that the reawakening had failed to arouse. Something crouched within him, Duncan thought. It was like a coiled spring waiting for release. "What more would you do?" Duncan asked. His voice sounded hoarse. "Your survival is in the balance here," Tag said. "All of this is being done to save you and get you to Ruckus. For Bene Gesserit reasons, which you say you do not know." "I don't know them, Duncan." "But you're a Mentat." "Mentats require data to make projections." "Do you think Lucilla knows?" "I'm not sure. But let me warn you again about her. She has orders to get you to Ruckus prepared for what you must do there." "Must?" Duncan shook his head from side to side. "Am I not my own person with rights to make my own choices? What do you think you've reawakened here? A damned face dancer capable only of obeying orders? Are you telling me you will not go to Ruckus?" "I'm telling you I will make my own decisions when I know what it is I'm to do. I'm not a hired assassin." "You think I am, Duncan?" "I think you're an honorable man, someone to be admired. Give me credit for having my own standards of duty and honor." "You've been given another chance at life, and..." "But you are not my father, and Lucilla is not my mother." "Imprinter? But what does she hope to prepare me?" "It may be that she does not know, Duncan. Like me, she may have only part of the design. Knowing how the sisterhood works, that is highly likely. So the two of you just train me and deliver me to Arrakis. Here's the package you ordered." "This is a far different universe than the one where you were originally born," Tag said. "As it was in your day, we still have a great convention against atomics and the pseudo-atomics of lase-gun-shield interaction. We still say that sneak attacks are forbidden. There are pieces of paper scattered around to which we have put our names, and we..." "But the no-ships have changed the basis for all of those treaties," Duncan said. "I think I learned my history fairly well at the Keep. Tell me, Bashar, why did Paul's son, Halitlilazu, provide him with my Gola self, hundreds of me, for all those thousands of years?" "Paul's son? The Keep's records call him the God Emperor. You name him Tyrant." "Oh, I don't think we know why he did it. Perhaps he was lonely for someone from..." "You brought me back to confront the worm," Duncan said. "Is that what we're doing?" Tag wondered. He had considered this possibility more than once, but it was only a possibility, not a projection. Even so, there had to be something more in Taraza's design. Tag sensed this with every fiber of his Mentat training. Did Lucilla know? Tag did not delude himself that he could pry revelation from a full reverend mother. No, he would have to bide his time, wait and watch and listen. In his own way, this obviously was what Duncan had decided. It was a dangerous course if he thwarted Lucilla. Tag shook his head. Truly, Duncan, I do not know. But you follow orders, by my oath to the sisterhood. Deceptions, dishonesties, those are empty words when the question is the sisterhood's survival, Duncan quoted him. Yes, I said that, Tag agreed. I trust you now because you said it, Duncan said. But I do not trust Lucilla. Tag dropped his chin to his breast. Dangerous. Dangerous. Much more slowly than once he had done, Tag brought his attention out of such thoughts and went through the mental cleansing process, concentrating on the necessities laid upon him by Terraza. You are my Bashar. Duncan studied the Bashar for a moment. Fatigue lines were obvious on the old man's face. Duncan was reminded suddenly of Tag's great age, wondering if it ever tempted men such as Tag to seek out the Tlilazu and become Golas. Probably not. They knew they might become Tlilazu puppets. This thought flooded Duncan's awareness, holding him immobile so plainly that Tag, lifting his gaze, saw it at once. Is something wrong? The Tlilazu have done something to me. Something that has not yet been exposed, Duncan husked. Exactly what we feared. It was Lucilla speaking from the doorway behind Tag. She advanced to within 2 paces of Duncan. I have been listening. You two are very informative. Tag spoke quickly, hoping to blunt the anger he sensed in her. He has mastered the 7 attitudes today. He strikes like fire, Lucilla said. But remember that we of the sisterhood flow like water and fill in every place. She glanced down at Tag. Do you not see that our Gola has gone beyond the attitudes? No fixed position, no attitude, Duncan said. Tag looked up sharply at Duncan, who stood with his head erect, his forehead smooth, his eyes clear as he returned Tag's gaze. Duncan had grown surprisingly in the short time since being awakened to his original memories. Damn you, Miles, Lucilla muttered. But Tag kept his attention on Duncan. The youth's entire body seemed wired to a new kind of vigor. There was a poise about him that had not been there before. Duncan shifted his attention to Lucilla. You think you will fail in your assignment? Surely not, she said. You're still a male. And she thought, yes, that young body must flow hot with the juices of procreation. Indeed, the hormonal igniters are all intact and susceptible to arousing. His present stance, though, and the way he looked at her, forced her to raise her awareness to new, energy-demanding levels. What have the Tlilazu done to you? She demanded. Duncan spoke with a flippancy that he did not feel. Oh, great imprinter, if I knew, I would tell you. You think it's a game we play? She demanded. I do not know what it is we play at. By now, many people know we are not on Rakkas where we would have been expected to flee, she said. And Gamu swarms with people returned from the scattering, Tag said. They have the numbers to explore many possibilities here. Who would suspect the existence of a lost no-globe from the Harkonnen days? Duncan asked. Anyone who made the association between Rakkas and Dar es Balat, Tag said. If you think this is a game, consider the urgencies of the play, Lucilla said. She pivoted on 1 foot to concentrate on Tag. And you have disobeyed Terraza. You are wrong. I have done exactly what she ordered me to do. I am her Bashar, and you forget how well she knows me. With an abruptness that shocked her to silence, the subtleties of Terraza's maneuverings impressed themselves upon Lucilla. We are pawns. What a delicate touch Tarazza always demonstrated in the way she moved her pawns about. Lucilla did not feel diminished by the realization that she was a pawn. That was knowledge bred and trained into every reverend mother of the sisterhood. Even Teg knew it. Not diminished, no. The thing around them had escalated in Lucilla's awareness. She felt awed by Teg's words. How shallow had been her previous view of the forces within which they were enmeshed. It was as though she had seen only the surface of a turbulent river, and, from that, had glimpsed the currents beneath. Now, however, she felt the flow all around her, and a dismaying realization. Pawns are expendable. By your belief in singularities, in granular absolutes, you deny movement, even the movement of evolution. While you cause a granular universe to persist in your awareness, you are blind to movement. When things change, your absolute universe vanishes, no longer accessible to your self-limiting perceptions. The universe has moved beyond you. First draft, Atreides Manifesto, Bene Gesserit Archives. Tarazza put her hands beside her temples, palms flat in front of her ears and pressed inward. Even her fingers could feel the tiredness in there, right between the hands, fatigue. A brief flicker of eyelids and she fell into the relaxation trance. Hands against head were the sole focal points of fleshly awareness. 100 heartbeats. She had practiced this regularly since learning it as a child, one of her first Bene Gesserit skills. Exactly 100 heartbeats. After all of those years of practice, her body could pace them automatically by an unconscious metronome. When she opened her eyes at the count of 100, her head felt better. She hoped she would have at least 2 more hours in which to work before fatigue overcame her once more. Those 100 heartbeats had given her extra years of wakefulness in her lifetime. Tonight, though, thinking of that old trick sent her memory spiraling backward. She found herself caught in her own childhood, the dormitory with the sister proctor pacing the aisle at night to make sure they all remained properly asleep in their beds. Sister Baram, the night proctor. Tarazza had not thought of that name in years. Sister Baram had been short and fat, a failed reverend mother. Not for any immediately visible reason, but the medical sisters and their souk doctors had found something. Baram had never been permitted to try the spice agony. She had been quite forthcoming about what she knew of her defect. It had been discovered while she was still in her teens, periodic nerve tremors, which manifested when she began to sink into sleep. A symptom of something deeper that had caused her to be sterilized. The tremors made Baram wakeful in the night. Aisle patrol was a logical assignment. Baram had other weaknesses not detected by her superiors. A wakeful child toddling to the washroom could lure Baram into low-voiced conversation. Naive questions elicited mostly naive answers, but sometimes Baram imparted useful knowledge. She had taught Tarazza the relaxation trick. One of the older girls had found Sister Baram dead in the washroom one morning. The night proctor's tremors had been the symptom of a fatal defect, a fact important mostly to the breeding mistresses and their endless records. Because the Bene Gesserit did not usually schedule the full solo death education until well into the acolyte stage, Sister Baram was the first dead person Tarazza had seen. Sister Brahm's body had been found partly beneath a wash basin, the right cheek pressed to the tile floor, her left hand caught in the plumbing under a sink. She had tried to pull her failing body upright, and death had caught her in the attempt, exposing that last motion like an insect caught in amber. When they rolled Sister Baram over to carry her away, Tarazza saw the red mark where her cheek had been pressed to the floor. The day proctor explained this mark with a scientific practicality. Any experience could be turned into data for these potential Reverend Mothers to incorporate later into their acolyte conversations with death. Post-mortem lividity. Seated at her chapter house table all of those years removed from the event, Terraza was forced to use her carefully focused powers of concentration to dispel that memory, leaving her free to deal with the work spread before her. So many lessons. So fearfully full her memory. So many lifetimes stored there. It reaffirmed her sense of being alive to see the work in front of her. Things to do. She was needed. Eagerly, Terraza bent to her labors. Damn the necessity to train the Gola on Gemu. But this Gola required it. Familiarity with dirt underfoot preceded the required restoration of that original persona. It had been wise to send Burzmali into the Gamu arena. If Miles had really found a hideaway, if he were to emerge now, he would need all the help he could get. Once more, she considered whether it was time to play the prescient game. So dangerous. And the Tlilazu had been alerted that the replacement Gola might be required. Ready him for delivery. Her mind swung to the raucous problem. That fool Tuwek should have been monitored more carefully. How long could a face dancer safely impersonate him? There was no faulting Odraid's on-scene decision, though. She had put the Tlilazu into an untenable position. The impersonator could be exposed, plunging the Beni Tlilax into a sink of hatred. The game within the Bene Gesserit design had become very delicate. For generations now, they had held out to the Rakian priesthood the bait of Bene Gesserit alliance. But now, the Tlilaxu must consider that they had been chosen instead of the priests. Odraid's three-cornered alliance let the priests think every Reverend Mother would take the oath of subservience to the divided god. The priestly council would stutter with excitement at the prospect. The Tlilazu, of course, saw the chance to monopolize Melange, controlling at last the one source independent of them. A rap at Terraza's door told her the acolyte had arrived with tea. It was a standing order when the Mother Superior worked late. Terraza glanced at the table chrono, an Ixion device so accurate it would gain or lose only 1 second in a century. 1:23:11 a.m. She called to admit the acolyte. The girl, a pale blonde with coldly observant eyes, entered and bent to arrange the contents of her tray beside Terraza. Terraza ignored the girl and stared at the work remaining on the table. So much to do. Work was more important than sleep. But her head ached, and she felt the telltale, dazed sensation akin to a stunned brain that told her the tea would provide little relief. She had worked herself into mental starvation, and it would have to be put right before she could even stand. Her shoulders and back throbbed. The acolyte started to leave, but Terraza motioned for her to wait.
Rub my back, please, sister.
The acolyte's educated hand slowly worked out the constrictions in Terraza's back.
Good girl.
Terraza smiled at this thought. Of course she was good. No lesser creature could be assigned to the Mother Superior. When the girl had gone, Terraza sat silently in deep thought.
So little time.
She begrudged every minute of sleep. There was no escaping it, though. Eventually, the body made its unavoidable demands. She had pressed herself beyond easy recuperation for days now. Ignoring the tea laid up beside her, Terraza arose and went down the hall to her tiny sleeping cell. There she left a call with the night guard for 11 a.m. and composed herself fully robed on the hard cot. Quietly, she regulated her breathing, insulated her senses from distraction, and fell into the between state. Sleep did not come. She went through her full repertoire, and still sleep evaded her. Terraza lay there for a long time, recognizing at last the futility of willing herself to sleep with any of the techniques at her disposal. The between state would have to do its slow mending first. Meanwhile, her mind continued to churn. The Rockian priesthood she had never considered to be a central problem. Already caught up in religion, the priests could be manipulated by religion. They saw the Bene Gesserit chiefly as a power that could enforce their dogma. Let them continue to think this. It was bait that would blind them. Damn that Miles Teg. 3 months of silence and no favorable report from Burzmali either. Charred ground. Signs of a no-ship's liftoff. Where could Teg have gone? The Golda might be dead. Teg had never before done such a thing. Old reliability. That was why she had chosen him. That and his military skills, and his likeness to the old Duke Leto. All of the things they had prepared in him. Teg and Lucilla, a perfect team. If not dead, was the Gola beyond their reach? Did the Tlilazu have him? Attackers from the scattering? Many things were possible. Old reliability. Silent. Was his silence a message? If so, what was he trying to say? With both Shuang Yu and Patrine dead, there was the smell of conspiracy around the Gamu events. Could Teg be someone planted long ago by the Sisterhood's enemies? Impossible. His own family was proof against such doubts. Teg's daughter at the family home was as mystified as anyone. 3 months now and not a word. Caution. She had warned Teg to exercise the utmost caution in protecting the Gola. Teg had seen the great danger on Gemu. Shuang Yu's last reports made that clear. Where could Teg and Lucilla have taken the Gola? Where had they acquired a no-ship? Conspiracy. Taraza's mind kept circling around her deep suspicions. Was it Odraid's doing? Then who conspired with Odraid? Lucilla? Odraid and Lucilla had never met before that brief encounter on Gamu. Or had they? Who bent close to Odraid and breathed the mutual air, weighted with whispers? Odraid gave no sign, but what proof was that? Lucilla's loyalty had never been doubted. They both functioned perfectly as assigned, but so would conspirators. Facts. Taraza hungered for facts. The bed rustled beneath her, and her sense insulation collapsed, shattered by worries as much as by the sound of her own movements. Resignedly, Taraza once more composed herself for relaxation. Relaxation and then sleep. Ships from the scattering flitted through Taraza's fatigue-fogged imagination. Lost ones returned in their uncounted no-ships. Was that where Teg found a ship? This possibility was being explored as quietly as they could on Gamu and elsewhere. She tried counting imaginary ships, but they refused to proceed in the orderly fashion required for sleep induction. Taraza came alert without moving on her cot. Her deepest mind was trying to reveal something. Fatigue had blocked that path of communication, but now she sat up fully awake. The Tlilazu had been dealing with people returned from the scattering. With these whorish honored maters, and with returned Bene Tlilax as well. Taraza sensed a single design behind events. The Lost Ones did not return out of simple curiosity about their roots. The gregarious desire to reunite all of humankind was not enough in itself to bring them back. The honored maters clearly came with dreams of conquest. But what if the Tlilazu sent out in the scattering had not carried with them the secrets of the axolotl tanks? What then? Melange. The orange-eyed whores obviously used an inadequate substitute. The people of the scattering might not have solved the mystery of the Tlilazu tanks. They would know about axolotl tanks and try to recreate them. But if they failed, melange. She began to explore this projection. The Lost Ones ran out of the true melange their ancestors took into the scattering. What sources did they have then? The worms of Rakis, and the original Benny Tleelax. The whores would not dare reveal their true interest. Their ancestors believed that the worms could not be transplanted. Was it possible the Lost Ones had found a suitable planet for the worms? Of course it was possible. They might begin bargaining with the Tleelazu as a diversion. Rakkis would be their real target. Or the reverse could be true. Transportable wealth. She had seen Teg's reports on the wealth being accumulated on Gamul. Some among the ones returning had coinages and other negotiable chips. That much was plain from the banking activities. What greater currency was there, though, than the spice? Wealth. That was it, of course. And whatever the chips, the bargaining had begun. Tarasa grew aware of voices outside her door. The acolyte sleep guard was arguing with someone. The voices were low, but Tarasa heard enough to bring her into full alert. She left a wake-up for late morning, the sleep guard protested. Someone else whispered, "She said she was to be told the moment I returned." "I tell you, she is very tired. She needs to be obeyed. Tell her I'm back." Tarasa sat up and swung her legs over the edge of the cot. Her feet found the floor. Gods, how her knees ached. It pained her, too, that she could not place the intruding whisper, the person arguing with her guard. "Whose return did I?" "Burzmali." "I'm awake," Tarasa called. Her door opened and the sleep guard leaned in. "Mother Superior, Burzmali has returned from Gamul." "Send him in at once." Tarasa activated a single glow globe at the head of her cot. Its yellow light washed away the room's darkness. Burzmali entered and closed the door behind him. Without being told, he touched the sound insulation switch on the door, and all other noises vanished. Privacy? It was bad news, then. She looked up at Burzmali. He was a short, slender fellow with a sharply triangular face narrowing to a thin chin. Blonde hair swept over a high forehead. His widely spaced green eyes were alert and watchful. He looked far too young for the responsibilities of a Bashar. But then Teg had looked even younger at Arbelo. "We are getting old, damn it." She forced herself to relax and place her trust in the fact that Teg had trained this man and expressed full confidence in him. "Tell me the bad news," Tarasa said. Burzmali cleared his throat. "Still no sign of the Bashar and his party on Gamul, Mother Superior." He had a heavy, masculine voice. "And that's not the worst of it," Tarasa thought. She saw the clear signs of Burzmali's nervousness. "Let's have it all," she ordered. "Obviously, you have completed your examination of the keep's ruins." "No survivors," he said. "The attackers were thorough." "Tleelazu?" "Possible." "You have doubts?" "The attackers used that new Ixian explosive. 12 Uri. I think it may have been used to mislead us. There were mechanical brain probe holes in Shuang Yu's skull, too." "What of Patrine?" "Exactly as Shuang Yu reported. He blew himself up in that decoy ship. They identified him from bits of two fingers and one intact eye. There was nothing left big enough to probe." "But you have doubts. Get to them. Shuang Yu left a message that only we might read." "In the wear marks on furniture?" "Yes, Mother Superior, and..." "Then she knew she would be attacked and had time to leave a message." "I saw your earlier report on the devastation of the attack. It was quick and totally overpowering. The attackers did not try to take captives."
"What did she say?"
"Whores." Tarasa tried to contain her shock, although she had been expecting that word. The effort to remain calm almost drained her energies. This was very bad. Terraza permitted herself a deep sigh. Shuang Yu's opposition had persisted to the end, but then, seeing disaster, she had made a proper decision. Knowing she would die without the opportunity to transfer her memory lives to another reverend mother, she had acted from the most basic loyalty. If you can do nothing else, arm your sisters and frustrate the enemy.
So the honored matrons have acted.
Tell me about your search for the Gola, Terraza ordered. We were not the first searchers over that ground, Mother Superior. There was much additional burning of trees and rocks and underbrush. But it was a no-ship. The marks of a no-ship.
Terraza nodded to herself.
A silent message from old reliability? How closely did you examine the area?
I flew over it, but on a routine trip from one place to another.
Terraza motioned Burzmali to a chair near the foot of her cot. Sit down and relax. I want you to do some guessing for me.
Burzmali lowered himself carefully onto the chair.
Guessing? You were his favorite student. I want you to imagine that you are Miles Tegg. You know you must get the Gola out of the keep. You do not place your full trust in anyone around you, not even in Lucilla. What will you do?
An unexpected thing, of course.
Of course.
Burzmali rubbed his narrow chin. Presently he said, I trust Patrine. I trust him fully.
All right, you and Patrine. What do you do?
Patrine is a native of Gamu.
I have been wondering about that myself, she said.
Burzmali looked at the floor in front of him. Patrine and I will make an emergency plan long before it is needed. I always prepare secondary ways of dealing with problems.
Very good. Now, the plan. What do you do?
Why did Patrine kill himself? Burzmali asked.
You're sure that's what he did?
You saw the reports. Shuang Yu and several others were sure of it.
I accept it.
Patrine was loyal enough to do that for his bashar.
For you, you are Miles Tegg now.
What plan have you and Patrine concocted?
I would not deliberately send Patrine to certain death. Unless...
Patrine did that on his own. He might if the plan originated with him and not with... me. He might do it to protect me, to make sure no one discovered the plan.
How could Patrine summon a no-ship without our learning of it?
Patrine was a Gamu native. His family goes back to the Gaiety Prime days.
Terraza closed her eyes and turned her head away from Burzmali.
So Burzmali followed the same suggestive tracks that she had been probing in her mind. We knew Patrine's origins. What was the significance of that Gamu association? Her mind refused to speculate. This was what came of allowing herself to become too tired. She looked once more for Burzmali.
Did Patrine find a way to make secret contact with a family and old friends?
We've explored every contact we could find.
Depend on it. You haven't traced them all.
Burzmali shrugged.
Of course not. I have not acted on that assumption.
Terraza took a deep breath.
Go back to Gamu. Take with you as much help as our security can spare. Tell Balanda those are my orders. You must insinuate agents into every walk of life. Find out who Patrine knew. What of his surviving family, friends? Winkle them out.
That will cause a stir no matter how careful we are. Others will know.
That cannot be helped. And Burzmali.
He was on his feet.
Yes, Mother Superior. The other searchers, you must stay ahead of them.
May I use a guild navigator?
No!
Then how...
Burzmali!
What if Miles and Lucilla and Argola are still on Gamu? I've already told you that I do not accept the idea of their leaving in a no-ship. For a long, silent period, Terrazza studied the man standing at the foot of her cot, trained by Miles Teg, the old Bashar's favorite student. What was Burzmali's trained instinct suggesting? In a low voice, she prompted, "Yes?" "Gamu was Jaya Deep Prime, a Harkonnen place. What does that suggest to you?" "They were rich, Mother Superior. Very rich." "So?" "Rich enough to accomplish the secret installation of a no-room, even of a large no-globe." "There are no records. Ix has never even vaguely suggested such a thing. They have not probed on Gamu for bribes, third-party purchases, many trans-shipments," Burzmali said. "The famine times were very disruptive, and before that, there were all those millennia of the tyrant, when the Harkonnens kept their heads down or lost them. Still, I will admit the possibility." "Records could have been lost," Burzmali said. "Not by us or the other governments that survived. What prompts this line of speculation?" "Patrine?" "Ah." He spoke quickly. "If such a thing were discovered, a Gamu native might know about it. How many of them would know? Do you think they could have kept such a secret for..." "Yes, I see what you mean. If it were a secret of Patrine's family..." "I have not dared question any of them about it." "Of course not. But where would you look without alerting?" "That place on the mountain where the no-ship marks were left. It would require you to go there in person." "Very hard to conceal from spies," he agreed. "Unless I went with a very small force and seemingly on another purpose." "What other purpose?" "To place a funeral marker in memory of my old Bashar."
"Suggesting that we know he is dead."
"Yes. You've already asked the Tlilazu to replace Argola. That was a simple precaution and does not bear on..."
"Burzmali, this is extremely dangerous. I doubt we can mislead the kinds of people who will observe you on Gamu. The mourning of myself and the people I take with me will be dramatic and believable. The believable does not necessarily convince a wary observer. Do you not trust my loyalty and the loyalty of the people I will take with me?" Terrazza pursed her lips in thought. She reminded herself that fixed loyalty was a thing they had learned to improve upon from the Atreides pattern. How to produce people who command the utmost devotion. Burzmali and Teg both were fine examples.
"It might work," Terrazza agreed. She stared speculatively at Burzmali. Teg's favorite student could be right.
"Then I'll go," Burzmali said. He turned to leave.
"One moment," Terrazza said. Burzmali turned. "You will saturate yourselves with Cher, all of you. And if you're captured by face dancers, these new ones, you must burn your own heads or shatter them completely. Take the necessary precautions." The suddenly sobered expression on Burzmali's face reassured Terrazza. He had been proud of himself for a moment there. Better to dampen his pride. No need for him to be reckless.